Welcome to the War and Diplomacy podcast, produced by the Centre for War and Diplomacy at Lancaster University. The CWD provides the historical context and strategic analysis to inform understanding of today's geopolitical challenges, promoting discussion through research, teaching, consultancy, and public events.
Hello, I'm Marco Weiss. I'm a reader in international history and security at Lancaster University and the director of the Centre for War and Diplomacy. I am very glad to be joined today by South African scholar Evert Kleinhans. Evert is a senior lecturer in the Department of Military History at the Faculty of Military Science of Stellenbosch University. He lectures undergraduate and postgraduate modules on the evolution of warfare, African military history, and low-intensity conflict in Africa since 1945. His research interests include the South African participation in both world wars, insurgency and counterinsurgency in Africa, as well as the broad historical impact of climate and terrain on warfare. He has published widely on these topics in peer-reviewed journals and books. Evert formerly served as an officer in the South African National Defence Force, whereafter he was appointed as the archivist and later director of the Records, Archives and Museums Division of Northwest University in Potchefstroom in South Africa. His latest work is titled Hitler's South African Spies, Secret Agents and the Intelligence War in South Africa, and was published by Jonathan Ball Publishers this year. And it is this very book which will provide the basis for today's podcast interview. This podcast will hopefully show that it makes for fascinating reading, and I can only encourage our listeners to get the book and read it themselves. So, welcome to our podcast, Evert, and thank you very much for agreeing to do this. So if you don't mind, I will now start directly with asking you the questions, the many questions I have about your book. As a start, so what brought you to study the role of intelligence in South Africa during the Second World War?
Thank you for the opportunity, Marco. So what set me off on this trajectory to write the book was when I was completing my doctoral dissertation, it focused on the naval war in South African waters. And one of the chapters specifically focused on the naval intelligence war in South Africa. I really wanted to get to grips with why did the Germans send their submarines to South African waters, and what was the rationale behind it? What prompted them to make these decisions? And of course, for them to dispatch their U-boats or their raiders to South African waters, they needed accurate intelligence. So that's where I started, you know, scratching the surface and getting to grips with what was happening in the South African home front. And When I wrote the dissertation, as you know, sometimes what we write in our academic treatises, there's always a lot more to it that we don't include in the chapter per se. So I realized there and then that there was far more to the story than what I could just pitch in a chapter in the dissertation. So once I had graduated and a couple of years down the line, I pitched the idea to a publisher. I had been rejected actually a number of times before with some other ideas that I'd put forward, but the whole idea of spies seemed to have resonated with the publishing house, and without much difficulty, I was then given a contract, and I started writing this story of the intelligence war in South Africa, and it just manifested itself, you know, over the course of probably about 18 months or so. When I was writing the book, it was initially supposed to be published in 2020, but due to COVID-19, everything was pushed to the right, and it was only published this year in April.
Thank you. So perhaps many of our listeners, they don't necessarily are that familiar with South Africa's position and role in the Second World War. So can I therefore ask you perhaps to provide us with some background in order that we're able to understand your book?
So, I mean, I think it's quite an interesting question, and it's quite complex. It's a complex answer, but I'll try to break it down to something digestible. So South Africa occupied quite an interesting position at the outbreak of the war. South African society was quite divided on South African participation in the war. One side that under General Smuts, or Jan Smuts, that wanted to actively partake in the war in the war effort, you know, to play an active role, to fight alongside the British Commonwealth. And then on the other hand, you had Herzog, who was then the former prime minister, and some of the National Party supporters also under D.F. Malan, who did not support the South African war effort and who were completely opposed to South Africa taking part in the war. This sort of played out on the South African home front during the entire period of the war, where South African troops were deploying to East Africa, North Africa, even Italy and Madagascar, you know, fighting alongside the Allies. And then in South Africa, you had this, you had quite an activistic element within the society that was working against the war effort. And the principal organization that actually was against the South African war effort was an organization called the Ossewar Brandwag. In English, it would be the Oxwagon Sentinels. So it started out as a cultural movement in 1938, but as the war was declared, it grew into much more than just a cultural organization. And there was some resistance elements within this organization, some that would launch active resistance against the South African war effort, principally the Stormjaars. I can't think of the English name for that now, but they were planting bombs and robbing banks and trying to sabotage the Union's war effort. And then you also had it's the leader of this movement, Hans van Rensburg. He was referred to actually as public enemy number one at one stage. He was at the center of this organization, but he was also, as we'll talk about it a bit later on, he was the key figure that the Germans ultimately, in the end, made contact with to try and get some intelligence going in South Africa. So I think the reason why so many South Africans were against the war effort is quite interesting to just maybe dwell on it for a little bit. And it, we can tie it all back to the Anglo-Boer War, the second Anglo-Boer War that was waged between 1899 and 1902. So for many of the South Africans, the memory of the war still resonated with them. Many of them had parents or grandparents who fought in the war. And in the First World War, there was also the Afrikaner Rebellion that broke out within South Africa over the South African decision to wage war against Germany as well. So all of these events were quite fresh in the South African memory. And during the interwar period, we saw that South Africa also occupied quite an interesting position. It wanted to remain neutral, but it was unwilling to return some of the German possessions that it had acquired after the end of the First World War. And then after Hitler comes to power, South Africa plays quite an interesting game. It doesn't really know, does it want to oppose Hitler? Does it just want to sort of sit back and let him carry on? Of course, Germany was far away from South Africa, so they wouldn't feel the impact of the German militarization, or the German threat was quite far away for the South Africans. But Smuts and his supporters, of course, were more than willing to throw their lot in with the British once the war broke out.
Thank you. Yeah, so now the scene is set. Let's see if we can turn properly to your book. So the study of intelligence, as you know, is not a straightforward affair, and you make this quite clear in the introduction of your book. And also because unlike other fields in history and military history, it's very much this secretive nature of intelligence that doesn't leave many traces. So I'm just curious to know how you actually approached the research for your book.
Yes, Marco, no, it's really not a straightforward affair. I think it's important to just first note that the available historiography surrounding this intelligence war in South Africa and Southern Africa was for a long time dominated by mainly British historians. And these historians mainly wrote their accounts based on the documents housed at the National Archives in London. So all of the KV files from the files from the KV archival group, the MI5 files mainly, and they constructed the narratives just using those documents. So, of course, that offered a very good but a very one-sided account of what was happening in South Africa during the war. Now, when I worked at the archives at Northwest University, I was fortunate enough to sit next, well, to not sit next to actually be in charge of the Ossewar Brandwag archive by itself, and being able to read Afrikaans, obviously allowed me access to this archive, which for many of the British historians, they never gained access to it because of the language barrier, but also because of a gatekeeper mentality that had been in place at this archive. So some of my former mentors or forerunners that worked at the archive explicitly denied these British historians access to these archival materials. So I was now in a very fortunate position to try and find the harmony sort of, or the golden thread between both sets of documents, the British documents on the one hand, and then of course the Afrikaner documents at the Ossewaard Brandwag archive. And the value of the documents contained in this archive was that during the post-war period, the archivist at the Ossewaard Brandwag archive actually interviewed many of the German agents that had been part of this intelligence war in South Africa. And that offered quite a different take on events as what the British historians had beforehand. So that was where I started with trying to do the research for this book. But then, of course, I also realized that there was more to it. After the war, and we'll talk about it a bit later on, the South Africans tried to convict these so-called secret agents of high treason, especially the leader of the Ossewaard Brandwag. So there had to be some sort of a trail of documents that documented this. And this had sort of been, these documents had gone missing. So it took quite a number of years and scratching and sometimes, you know, playing a bit of Sherlock Holmes to try and get to the documents in question. But I think by casting my net as far and wide as possible, I was able ultimately to draw in enough material to make sense of this rather complex episode of South African history.
Absolutely fascinating. Yeah, real detective's work. So you referred already to some actors, but who did you identify as the main actors in South Africa's intelligence war? And could you please briefly present them to our listeners?
So I think there's, to start with, I think as I mentioned before, public enemy number one in South Africa was Hans van Rensburg, the leader of the Ossewaard Brandwag. And in the book, it becomes quite clear that he is, in fact, the main kingpin of the intelligence war in South Africa. So why do I say this? It's because every German agent or courier that was dispatched to South Africa, whether it was intended to or not, ultimately ended up making contact with Hans van Rensburg. And he was the person ultimately that the Germans later on in the war pinpointed as the direct person that they wanted to have contact with. So you had Hans van Rensburg as the head of this organization. And then he had quite a few trusted lieutenants working around him that obviously supported his dealings. But the principal German agents that operated in South Africa, I think, we can make a distinction between the agents and the couriers. The couriers, to start with, were a couple called Willem and Ricky Radley. And they were the first to have been dispatched from Germany to South Africa, carrying a message from the Abwehr to make contact, first of all, with the National Party and DF Malan. Both of those attempts failed, and the messages were intercepted by van Rensburg. And then the next person on the scene, I think that's worth mentioning, is a guy called Hans Roseboom, who was also dispatched to South Africa by the Abwehr. He's got quite a big mouth. So once he arrived in South Africa, the police soon picked up on his story and his adventure and his whereabouts, and he was interned. He's ultimately helped to escape by the Ossewaard Brandwag from the internment camp, and he sets up quite a rudimentary espionage or intelligence organization in South Africa that doesn't really collect intelligence, but it reports on the intelligence to Lorenzo Marx, which is modern-day Maputo in Mozambique. And then the biggest spy of the story is a guy called Lothar Zittig. His code name was Felix, and he is the most enduring of all of these agents. He operates in South Africa for a period of about 2 years. He's in charge of collecting and disseminating political and naval intelligence to Germany. And it's a fascinating story of how these guys rob hospitals and construct a wireless transmitter that's strong enough to transmit the intelligence directly to Berlin in the end, which I think is a phenomenal feat. I don't think we'll speak about the value of the intelligence later on, but you've got to give them some kudos for what they managed to pull off. But I think the last actors that we sort of got to talk about is the Trompke Network, which was the main German intelligence organization in Southern Africa, and they operated out of Mozambique. And the network was named after the consul general, Paul Trompke, and one of his secretaries at the German legation, a guy called Leopold Wertz. He was the spy chief, if you can call him that. And he was the one that that orchestrated contact with Hans von Rensburg in South Africa, and that also initially all of the intelligence went to before it was dispatched to Berlin. So I think it was, I mean, these are just some of the figures that I've highlighted out now, but there are many more involved in this story, rich, colorful characters and interesting events that sort of brings them together in this story.
Yeah, it's definitely fascinating reading in your book about these different characters, and also they're not only their supposedly professional intelligence lives, but also their private lives, of course. Now, moving a bit temporarily, shifting the geographical focus, perhaps from Southern Africa to Germany, Nazi Germany, what kind of intelligence was Nazi Germany actually after in South Africa and Southern Africa more generally? And what were they hoping to get from this intelligence?
Well, Marco, I think there's two categories that we can talk about. There's naval intelligence and then political intelligence. That's what the Germans were after. So naval intelligence, if you picture the strategic location of South Africa on the global maritime trade network at the southern point of Africa, we occupy quite an important geographical location. And of course, during the war, this position was exacerbated after the Italian entry into the war and the closure of the Mediterranean to Allied shipping. And that meant that all shipping traversing east and west, or west and east, whichever way you wanted, now had to round the Cape of Good Hope. So, of course, there was a great amount of both naval and merchant shipping now traveling along the South African coastline and visiting South African ports. So if the Germans could determine the amount of shipping, the tonnage that was calling at South African ports, they could make the equation and see if it warrants, you know, the dispatching of a wolf pack to South African waters to launch a determined attack against merchant shipping. And this actually occurs in October 1942. We see that there's a big surprise operation launched against shipping in the waters of South Africa. It's called Operation Ice Bar. And it really catches the Allies and the South Africans completely unaware. So they sink a large number of shipping. And so that was the one thing. The Germans wanted to determine what type of shipping was traveling along the South African coast and to which directions. And could they then dispatch the U-boats or raiders or whatever to interdict that shipping? So that was on the one end, naval intelligence. And they were partially successful in it, but also maybe not. Maybe we speak about that a bit later. The second category was political intelligence. So Germany was well aware that there was an element of the South African society that was decidedly anti-war and anti-smuts. So if they could get a feel of what was happening in the country or the mood of the nation, they could use political intelligence or subterfuge to sort of work against the South African war effort and influence the population to turn against the South African war effort. So they managed to get a sense of what was happening in the country. But ultimately, the political intelligence in the end of the war, it actually boiled down to mainly being von Rensburg's speeches that was being broadcasted via Radio Zeissen in Germany. So it's questionable what the value of the political intelligence was in the end, especially from probably from about 1943 onwards, after the South African general election again, and Smuts is still in power. So that's what they were after, political and naval intelligence.
Yeah, fascinating. Thank you for presenting that so clearly. Now, you referred to the transmission of intelligence to Berlin already and to some other activities. But so how more specifically did Hitler's South African spies collect intelligence, and how did they transmit it or pass it on to Nazi Germany?
Yeah, no, Marcus, I think to answer that question, I think it's valuable to make the distinction again between the naval intelligence and the political intelligence. So if you put yourself in the shoes of these South African or these people that worked against the South African war effort that were collecting intelligence. Those working at the South African ports that were members of the Osava Brandwacht, they would report on shipping that were visiting the harbors, and a lot of gossip in the dockside. They would probably be able to pick up in which direction the ship was traveling and what cargo it was carrying, etc. It was the days before WhatsApp and emails, so the intelligence would be collected. It would be put on a train in Cape Town, for example, which would then journey all the way up through South Africa, through the Karoo. It would probably take 2 days to get to Johannesburg or so, where it would be collected again, taken to Pretoria, which is to the north of Johannesburg. It would then be taken to Hans van Rensburg's farm on the outskirts of Pretoria. It would be collated. They would look through it and determine if it was worth reporting on. And then it would be taken by road again to another location, from where they would then report it via wireless transmitter, first to Lorenzo Marx sometimes initially, and then it would be dispatched via telegram from Mozambique to Germany. And then someone in Germany would have to decide, listen here, is this intelligence actually worthwhile? It would have to be sent to Admiral Dönitz and the U-boat command, and they would have to then dispatch it to a U-boat to try and launch a surprise attack. So it was a very tedious process. And by the time the intelligence actually probably reached a U-boat, it would have been quite outdated. So this is how they did it. Initially, as I mentioned, the South Africans sent the intelligence via courier to Mozambique, and then the Tromke network would dispatch it to Germany. The problem was that the Germans in Mozambique could decide if they wanted to, if they didn't want to send on the intelligence, or if they thought it was nonsensical, then they wouldn't send it on. So the Osava Brandwacht ultimately wanted to build their own wireless transmitter, which they did. And from 1943 onwards, they were able to send their intelligence directly to Berlin and receive messages back from Berlin. So that's how they did that, the naval intelligence. The political intelligence was a lot easier, obviously, to report on. But as I mentioned, in the end, it boiled down to van Rensburg's speeches, because his speeches were no longer allowed to be published in newspapers. So that was one way to get some of his speeches out to the South African public. It was to transmit it to Germany and then play it back over radios. Yes. And so basically, the intelligence that they collected and how they passed it on to Germany was quite interesting and novel. The value of the intelligence was questionable. On the one account that I've picked up on, they even reported on the monthly consumption of potatoes in South Africa. So you've got to ask yourself, you know, what were the Germans going to do with that? Figure out that the South Africans like potatoes. That's about all they could do with that. So it was questionable.
Yeah, thank you. So now moving a bit from the spies to those actually who try to apprehend or prevent the spies from carrying out their activity. So many of these spies, as one can read in your book, they did not remain undetected. So what were the South African governments and the Allies and most notably Britain's counterintelligence efforts and perhaps resulting successes?
Yes, so indeed, these guys didn't remain undetected. They, in fact, they were picked up on from the very get-go. So from about 1941, the British especially, they were aware of what was happening in South Africa, and they were able to monitor all of these illicit wireless communications within South Africa. And they were able to do that through the Y organization of the Royal Navy that operated in South Africa. So they were responsible for all wartime signals intelligence. So they kept a watch on all naval traffic in South African waters, but also illicit wireless traffic within the Union of South Africa. So they picked up on everything that these guys did. They had quite a complete picture. So they would intercept the messages, and then the GCNCS at Bletchley Park would decode these messages, which they were able to do and read all of these messages. So the Allies, or at least the British, had quite a good picture of what was happening in South Africa. And if you go to the KV2 files at the National Archives in London, you can actually see the detailed picture that they had built up on Hans Roosterboom, on Lothar Zittig, etc. So it's fascinating when you see this. And of course, I think these guys were quite unaware that they were being monitored to such an extent. Now, the problem was that the British could not really trust the South African authorities because the civil service, at least the police force and the postal office, and probably the Union Defence Force as well, to a large extent, had been infiltrated by members with dubious loyalties who were either very pro-Afrikaner in outlook or pro-Ossewa Brandwag. And they would, whenever a concerted move was planned against the Felix transmitter, by the time the authorities would arrive at this farm in the older, the far west of South Africa, it would have been public knowledge for a long time already that this move was being planned and the transmitter would have been relocated or hidden away. So I think it really frustrated the British because they could never really make this move against these elements in South Africa. And then you had the Prime Minister, Jan Smuts, who also put certain conditions on these counterintelligence operations. You know, so yes, you can do it, but you can't execute it on Van Rensburg's farm, and you can't have him arrested, and you can't do all of these things. It came with a lot of conditions, which obviously frustrated the MI5 representative in South Africa, Michael Ryan. And you read about it in the book. This guy is down in the dumps by the end of the war because he doesn't know what he can do or what he can't do, and who he can trust and who he can't trust. But I think what was fascinating to me was, and this was what I mentioned a bit earlier about some of the documents that remained rather elusive, was after the war, the Smuts government made a determined move to charge all South Africans of treason. So this included South African civilians who assisted the German war effort and also South African servicemen in uniform who had then either joined the British Free Corps, etc., or acted as stool pigeons in the POW camps. So for my part of the story, there was two missions established to investigate this. The one was the Ryan mission. They were more involved with the men in uniform that committed treasonable acts. But then the Barrett mission was established to now really investigate Hans von Rensburg and the Ossewa Brandwag and their contact with Nazi Germany during the war. And we see that this mission is dispatched to Europe, gathers a lot of incriminating evidence, all of the MI5 reports, all of the intercepted wireless messages. It's all given, and this big docket of treason is built against Hans von Rensburg, and it's titled Rex versus Hans von Rensburg and the Ossewa Brandwag, etc. And it's quite a thick document. And when I was writing this book, or actually before I even started writing the book, I was trying to get my hands on a copy of this document because I picked up on snippets of it in various other archives, but never the complete document. And visiting the National Archive in South Africa, where this document should have been, as it was reported by the former Prime Minister, where it was handed over to, you couldn't find a copy of this document. It just doesn't exist. And I just started scratching further and further, and eventually I came upon the administrative files of the Barrett mission, which opened, you know, this whole picture in front of me. And it was very rewarding because you could use simple run-of-the-mill administrative files to actually put together the missing narrative that had disappeared from the South African historiography. I managed to, in the end, locate a partial copy of this Barrett report, or this docket against Van Rensburg. I say it is partial because it doesn't contain the intercepted wireless messages, but in the end, that document just reinforced what I had already found in the administrator file. So for me, it proved that, I mean, people might agree with me or disagree with me. I argue that the National Party rather conveniently put the document away behind a closed door and forgot about it, or didn't file it or didn't report on it. Because of the various members of even the National Party that was implicated in this story. But you can never really hide it, the truth completely. There's always snippets of information lying everywhere, and especially in different archives. So if you're willing to scratch far and wide, you can sometimes find some interesting information.
Thank you. Yeah, that's fascinating. Sort of to somehow sum up before we go to the very last question, I have a question. So what was actually the impact Hitler's South African spies had on the course of the war? And you sort of related to that already when you mentioned certain reports after the war that were trying to find out the truth and investigation. So how were these spies tried after the war? What happened to them?
Marco, short and sweet, nothing happened to them. So maybe before I carry on with that, what impact did they have on the course of the war? Not much, I would argue. As I said before, I think it was a great adventure for them. They were playing cowboys and crooks, as we like to call it in South Africa. They had a jolly old good time, and they thought that they were contributing to the broader German war effort. But I mean, realistically, if you look at the available information, and if you consider the lengthy turnaround time of naval intelligence itself and what they'd reported on, like the potatoes and only Hans von Rensburg's speeches, then it was really quite questionable what influence it had on the German war effort. Especially when, if you consider that the Felix transmitter only really became operational in 1943, by which time already the war effort had turned already against Germany, especially in Africa already. I mean, the Allies already had invaded into Sicily, and Italy was to follow soon, and Normandy close thereafter. So the intelligence that they were reporting on from South Africa could in no way turn the war effort. So I don't think it had any impact really on the course of the war. How were they tried after the war? They weren't tried at all. The people mentioned in this Barrett report, especially Hans von Rensburg and some of his co-accused, the matter was supposed to go before the courts in 1948. But as we all know, the National Party won the South African general election in 1948 and they came to power. This Barrett report was briefly debated in Parliament for 1 or 2 days. And then all of the copies of the report, I think there were six, they were all collected and they were deposited with the state archivist. And as I've mentioned in the previous question, they were locked away and we never saw them again. So von Rensburg, even though he was guilty, completely guilty of high treason and aiding the German war effort, and his trusted lieutenants and these German agents, nothing happened to them, nothing at all. In fact, they were actually a bit revered after the war. I think it brought them some street cred as well in South Africa. So nothing really happened to them. The Osovar Brandwacht as an organization ceased to exist shortly after 1948, I think in 1951. So this episode of South African history just was conveniently put on one side and forgotten about, but nothing happened. You can, as you mentioned earlier, you can support Hitler, you could be an active Nazi in South Africa, and in the end, nothing happened. But I think if Smuts remained in power, this case might very well have gone to the courts. I think he would have been very wary of it because he didn't want to create martyrs again, following the Afrikaner rebellion in the First World War, and also having charged Afrikaners or fellow Afrikaners then with treason and even executing some of them. I think it was a tight political rope that he was walking, and maybe he wouldn't have been too keen on actually going ahead with a capital charge.
Yeah, these domestic politics that play into these kind of things. And of course, the MP's victory and overall the MP doesn't speak for the MP's record, which is a bit tainted anyway, isn't it?
No, exactly. Yeah.
Now, so you researched the intelligence war and intelligence more generally in South Africa very exhaustively. Now, the question is there still more research to be done? And related to that, what is your current research agenda?
I think there's definitely scope for some more research in, well, I think at least in Southern Africa and the intelligence war. I think if there's any postgraduate student listening to this or any researcher that was looking for something new to tackle, I think the Trompka network that operated out of Lorenzo Marx, or at least Mozambique, I think that's something, it's been tackled in a few articles, but I think it deserves a bit more than that, maybe a postgraduate study or even a book. by anybody who's got the time and effort to really dig through it. There's a wealth of information out there that's available. And you just, it's there for the taking. Within South Africa, I think there's also room for anybody that really wants to look at Radio Ziersen that broadcasted the propaganda back to South Africa. There's been a few articles here and there, but again, it's a field that's open. This vehicle that was used to transmit propaganda and intelligence back to South Africa. So I think that's sort of, in terms of the intelligence war in South Africa and Southern Africa, those are some definite gaps that are available that can be looked at. And of course, not just the Tromke network in Mozambique, but also we often forget about Angola and Luanda, which I think would have been just as interesting with the amount of shipping traveling past Angola. So I think that's what I would put out there, the challenge to anybody that wants to do it. My current research, I am busy turning the PhD into an academic book, which is a bit dry and boring, but that's what we do. And then I am working on a book project with a colleague of mine on the South African way of war, where we are using some battles in the 20th century to look at the continuity and discontinuity in terms of the way that the South African Defence Force was fighting, sort of from the first deployment of the Defence Force in 1914 until a reverse that we suffered in the Central African Republic in 2013. So that's sort of where we are at the moment.
Fascinating. I'm looking forward to your forthcoming research when it's published. Thank you so much for joining me today and discussing your book, Hitler's South African Spies, and giving your insights into South Africa's position and role in the Second World War. A great thank you also to our listeners. So please don't forget to check out the Center for War and Diplomacy's other podcasts, which are available on Anchor, Spotify, and Apple. And of course, to read Evert's book, Hitler's South African Spies. Thank you very much, Evert.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear further podcasts, please visit the CWD website, lancaster.ac.uk/CWD. There you can find more on the CWD's research, events, and teaching, including the MA in International and Military History.